Hey there, I'm Tal Zlotnitsky from Ignite IT Consulting. You know me from the Braving Business podcast, but when I'm not behind the mic, I'm helping tech startups and established companies ignite their full potential. I also help entrepreneurs and businesses in distress reset for success. With over three decades of entrepreneurial success, I bring hands-on experience to drive growth, navigate turnarounds, raise capital, and lead through innovation. Whether it's executive coaching or strategic transformation, I'm here to turn your business challenges into success stories. Visit igniteitconsulting.com and let's spark that change together. That's igniteitconsulting.com. Your journey to business brilliance starts now.
And one last quick thing. If you enjoyed this episode, please stay on after the show to learn more about the Braving Business podcast and other great episodes for you to discover. And now, let's get the show started. Well, hello there.
Hey there. How are you?
I am good, man. How are you? Resplendent and blue.
I am. I'm well. I'm back in Tampa Bay where it's nice and warm. I've spent the last couple of weeks, as you know, in frigid Ontario. Mm-hmm. But I'm back on the warm shores of the Gulf of America. So, it's all good.
Oh God, that hurts my heart. So I was actually just outside, so I'm jealous. My beautiful wife and I just went for a walk and it's -5 right now. So it was a little cold out there. So I'm a little bit jealous, but I'm going to be down by you, albeit on the other side of Florida, coming up in a month.
Is that right?
Yes.
Where are you going and why are you going there?
Because we'll talk about Richard with this because he knows way more about this than most people. But my wife and I, her ride or die just gave us a cruise as a gift for Kara kicking cancer's ass. And so It's super cool. Like, I've never been on a cruise before and Lord knows I can't afford one, but this is like, it's called the Rock and Romance Cruise. So Air Supply is going to be on there. Kansas is going to be on there. Yeah. So it's going to be all these bands.
So this is not just your ordinary cruise. This is a VIP type cruise.
This is going to be a lot of air rock. You know, I'm going to be playing my air guitar and a lot of, 70s nostalgia. I think it's going to be a lot of fun.
Wow, it sounds amazing.
Yeah.
Rich was supposed to actually be in the area next week. I was looking forward to seeing him, and then he canceled on me. Uh-oh. So you're not coming, right? Or are you coming? Because I'm still on my calendar.
But I am going on that cruise with PJ.
Come on. Let's do it.
My wife and I just got tickets for Rod Stewart and Cheap Trick this summer.
Oh, there
so
you go.
I'm with you, PJ.
Yeah, Cheap Trick's great. A little Chicago flavor.
Well, not to be outdone, I just did see Neil Diamond, not the actual guy, but the Neil Diamond play in theater this weekend. It was lovely.
I saw that. I thought that was a really good production.
All three experiences are basically right, same level. It's perfect.
PJ, let's get going before we lose our audience.
No worries. So today we have the esteemed Dr. Richard Saphir, who has spent his career at the intersection of medicine, workplace culture, and human resilience, and he's not afraid to challenge the status quo. As Chief Medical Director of Employee Health and Well-Being at Johns Hopkins Medicine, he's leading the charge in creating healthier workspaces, not just with wellness programs, but by reshaping how companies think and prioritize well-being. In his book, A Cure for the Common Company, which is available on Amazon and wherever books are sold, he lays out a blueprint for a happier, healthier, and more resilient workforce, and his work has been featured by the Wall Street Journal, the Washington Post, and Fortune. But his journey wasn't exactly conventional. After 11 years of medical training, he realized that traditional family practice just wasn't his calling. So instead, he took an entrepreneurial path in medicine, building health and well-being strategies from the ground up at organizations that had never prioritized them before. Dr. Saphir has navigated organizational resistance, skeptics questioning ROI, and the uphill battle of making well-being a business priority, all while practicing what he preaches. He's an outdoorsman, a proud dad of three who recently celebrated 26 years of marriage, and at 57, he looks great, recently and bravely took his first hip-hop dance class What? His story is about resilience, reinvention, and redefining what health means in the modern workplace. Dr. Safir, welcome to Braving Business.
PJ, I don't know where you dug up the hip hop class. I can't deny it, but yes, I bravely took a hip hop class with my wife about a month ago.
I am impressed. Is there a move that you've nailed? Is there something that you have down in your repertoire?
Well, I don't think I've nailed anything in the hip hop genre, but after going to the class three times, we did come up with 60 seconds of a pretty sharp routine.
There you go.
Is that right?
Very good.
That's impressive. I will say that I would pay to see you do that, Rich. I've known Rich 24 years, and we were just debating whether I first met him at his son's bris. That's where I thought I met you.
Yeah.
Is that not where I met you?
Paul, I think we met a week earlier at, unfortunately, a funeral.
Oh, goodness.
I don't know. Yeah, I know. 1 week, I'm burying a friend, unfortunately, a guy who was about my age, and the next week we're having our son's bris.
You know what? You're absolutely right. I just remember that. And you know what? That's an interesting segue into the topic of health and well-being. So let's go there. You started off as a doctor, just a good old-fashioned doctor, right? Your career took a major turn, family practice, and then you took a turn towards health and well-being in the workplace. What was the specific moment that made you realize that traditional medicine, just being a doctor that goes to the office and sees patient, just wasn't your calling?
You know, I wish I could say it was a specific moment, but it wasn't. It was a year of going into the office and rushing from one patient to another and not ever having enough time to help my patient understand the true cause of their illness. It was kind of feeling like at the end of the year, like I wasn't making a difference. And at the same time, they're rushing back and forth between my office and their work. One day, or I should say like 1 month, or gradually, I just came to the realization that I need to be where they are. They're spending almost 2,000 hours a year in the workplace. That's where I can have a bigger impact.
That's fascinating. And that's very, very cool. It also, it's just like, you know, I have children who want to be doctors. So just knowing that very daunting path for all the studying and all the learning and everything, and then to get to that point and be like, yeah, but I'm not doing enough. The way you're describing it kind of reminds me of running around putting Band-Aids on people, really.
Yeah, there was only enough time to order a test or write a prescription. It really wasn't helping people with meaningful change.
Oh, wow. Wow. So you've had to build, so you went out into the corporate world and you're like, let me meet my patients where they are, which is, I think, awesome. There's my word again, awesome. And so you've had to build these well-being programs from scratch at major organizations like Care First and Johns Hopkins, and I'll tell you my Johns Hopkins story later. What was the biggest challenge in convincing leadership that employee health should be a business priority?
I wish I could say there was just one challenge, PJ, but the first one that came to my mind was being in front of the president of Johns Hopkins Health System, having just finished one presentation and having him ask the question, how are you going to measure your body of work? And me knowing that there was only 2 minutes left in the meeting time and being grateful that I had an out to say, hey, could I come back next time and give you a comprehensive answer? Now, the reason why I wanted to buy time was this president was the former chief financial officer of Johns Hopkins Health System. I was pretty sure he wanted a numbers answer that had to do with money. Mm. So I came back and pretty much nailed it, starting by telling him why we shouldn't measure money and giving him my recommendations, which he accepted. That was a pivotal moment, not just for me, but more importantly, it was a pivotal moment for Johns Hopkins Medicine to put us on a path to move forward.
It's interesting because many companies, not just obviously Johns Hopkins is in the health delivery business. You'd think they'd know better, but many companies treat employee well-being as an afterthought or a perk. What do you think is the biggest misconception that business leaders have about workplace health, and how do you change their minds?
Well, most business leaders are under-informed about the benefits, the variety of benefits that a healthy and well workforce bring. I mean, it's not just bringing down healthcare costs. It's also about avoiding workers' compensation claims. It's also about improving retention and increasing your appeal to help with talent acquisition. There's a variety of reasons that go well beyond and are well documented in published literature.
Very cool. So you kind of get this idea. You want to go meet people where they're at. You're talking to the big guns. They want to know the numbers. Did that make you take a step back and try to figure out how to talk in a language that they understood so that you can get what you wanted to accomplish?
Absolutely. I've always looked at the other person or the people in the room and asked myself, what is their language? I need to speak their language. And I'm not afraid to speak about numbers. In fact, I'm pretty good with numbers. I just am not willing to go down that path of return on investment for most well-being strategies. It's not to say that I don't talk finances. In fact, TJ, I talk finances all the time. I think that's one of the strengths that I bring to the well-being community, mostly because of my work at Blue Cross Blue Shield, where I came to appreciate the impact of not only diseases, but certain behaviors. So we can't avoid the conversation. We just need to get better informed about how the numbers intersect with our health and well-being.
Why do you think there's resistance in the corporate world to embracing wellness? What do you think it's rooted in?
I think there's probably a couple of things. I think that for one, most leaders don't recognize or have a inflated view of how well their workforce is. And Deloitte actually proved this in a pretty large survey. They surveyed not only employees, but the leaders of those organizations, and they found a disconnect in four different well-being domains. So just as an example, the physical well-being, there was like a 25% gap of how the employees rated their physical well-being, and the executives basically gave them a 25% bump. No, they're really doing well. So there's this misunderstanding. The second is some leaders have been burned before because they bought a they bought a promise that didn't turn out, and they burn me once, shame on me. So I think that leaders need to spend more time learning the art and science and the business aspect of well-being so that they can be better informed to make better decisions.
So that makes a ton of sense from your dealings with this and how you kind of crafted this response to go towards them to get what, you know, you're trying to accomplish. But was there a moment where you were like, okay, this is not going to work. I'm barking up the wrong tree or what, you know, however you want to say that. And how, once you got to that moment, how did you push through that?
Well, PJ, I mean, there's been many moments where things weren't going my way. I mean, including realizing that I'm a family doctor after 11 years of school and training, and it's not where I want to be. So, you know, I'm not one to say, you know, I'm going to throw my hands up. I just had to step back and look at the situation and take another path. So one example that comes to mind was our flagship effort to improve the beverage environment at Johns Hopkins Medicine. So we're on a mission to make it more likely for our workforce to drink healthy beverages. And we started off pretty well, but we hit some road bumps, and we weren't making much progress with some of our larger hospitals. The progress we were making at is with some of our smaller campuses. So I just, you know, checked out the literature. I'm like, okay, how are we going to change this organization? And I brushed up on organizational change. BJ, most people in health and well-being or workplace wellness, whatever you want to call it, they don't study organizational change, but they should. We need to understand all aspects of business if we're going to be effective. And so because of that, reminder and brushing up on it, I was able to change course, and ultimately our strategy followed through.
Can you share more about that? What did you discover through that was insightful to you?
Well, there's several organizational change models. So I'm not necessarily endorsing the one that I'm about to share with you, but it actually, you know, it worked for us at the time. It's something called the diffusion of innovation theory, which is about how different leaders fall on a spectrum of their willingness and ability to accept a new idea and move it through the organization. And so it's kind of like a bell-shaped curve where the innovators who are on the front end make up about 2.5% of the leadership. And those are the people who are the entrepreneurs of the group. They're willing to take a risk and try something new. And on the other side of the bell-shaped curve is the laggards, the people who actually stick their heels in the ground. And then there's three categories in between. And they all have a defined way of looking at proposed innovations. And if you understand where the person across the table fits in this paradigm, then you can adjust your message to win them over or avoid them in the case of the laggards. This was really helpful so that I could navigate the first layer. And Tal, ultimately, once I was able to start demonstrating success with some leaders and their parts of Hopkins, it started to play out like a domino, just like the theory said it would. The early adopters came after the innovators, and they started to have success. And then the middle group, ultimately, the laggards have to come along because they're the outliers. And eventually, you know, the top person is getting upset with them. It proved to be a very effective theory for that portion of our work.
So a quick follow-up on that. So as you said, the first step in any process like that is to recognize who's sitting in front of you. And one of the things I try to do in every episode is help our audience draw something from the guest that they can apply in whatever profession, whatever business they're in. What was one thing you looked for in your initial conversation with the leader? Was there a marker or a tell that told you where they fell on the bell curve?
Well, I'd say this with every leader. So if any of your audience reach out to me, you know that I could be thinking about you in the context of what is your opinion about well-being in the workplace. And some people are pretty overt. They're big fans of it. And some people are pretty overt and they absolutely know I'm not doing this. That's not usually the case. You kind of have to, you know, get to know them as an individual. What is their own health and well-being practice? And then work from there. And, you know, eventually, it's usually not one conversation that helps me understand everything, how they're going to respond. It's a journey. And especially when it's in a large organization, having to learn about so many different leaders. I would say that organizational change, I don't think you and PJ are going to be surprised, is going to be much easier at a smaller organization.
No, for sure. Yeah. It also just, it reminds me of some really long-term and proven sales tenets, which is basically do your homework, right?
Yeah.
Know your audience and do your homework.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, this is the problem. I don't mean to diss my community, but, you know, workplace wellness professionals for decades were solely focused on a particular behavior, like eating more apples or not smoking. And that's important. But if you don't know how to navigate an organization and know about organizational behavior, not just individual behavior, you're going to have a tough time making a big impact.
So in general, I mean, what I'm drawing from what you're saying is you were approaching this as anyone should when they're evaluating what they're going to need to do to get leadership buy-in to substantial change or evolution in practices. And generally, you're not, I mean, you may run into an innovator, as you said, whose mind is already, he or she is already there. They, mm-hmm. Before you walked in the door, they were already there and they invited you in because frankly, they're looking to ride your coattails and your experience and expertise to something that they already believe in and aspire to do. that's the best case scenario. So if you're in the audience and you're in any profession, hopefully in your career, you'll come across a handful of these. I have. Those are the most amazing moments. You run into someone who's already there, whatever you're selling, whatever your vision is, they're there, they're with you, they're on board. The toughest challenge is to be able to tell in the remaining group, which are those that you would be barking up the wrong tree and wasting your time, and which are those that can be brought along. I'm going back to a tipping point, right? Because I do believe that there are tells, right? Now, I don't know what they might be in your profession.
Yeah.
In my profession, I know of several. Was there something that you learned, hey, when I hear this phrase or when the conversation goes down this path, this is a person who is going to be a laggard and I'm better off focusing my time, my energy elsewhere for the time being, even if within the same organization?
So I, in some ways, have been lucky because the laggards have identified themselves very quickly. They're very cynical about health and well-being. People don't.
That's often the case in anything, in my experience.
Right. So the laggards that aren't overt very well could be just late adopters. But let's say that there are some laggards who are not overt. Just asking them, hey, what do you like to do outside of work? Oh, I like to smoke cigars and, you know, drink beer and sit on the sofa and watch movies all day. That's very different than, hey, I'm going to go to Jamaica and lift weights and swim a lot. I mean, that's a different person. So I think just that simple question, and if you are in the position to ask this person to go to lunch, you might also learn something about their food preferences, which could be reflective of their value for health and well-being. I'm all for being subtle so that they don't throw you out of the room.
You know, this kind of touches on something that I think Tal will agree with me on, is that there's a lot of corporations that kind of seem to overlook or forget that their true assets are the people that are in the organization.
And without a doubt.
And the more you look after them and the more you take care of them and the more you look after their well-being, the better the organizational health is as a whole. And what you're saying is it's so common sense, but it's so hard for some corporations to get that because they don't really see health as a benefit, right? Like I once, really quick story, I was a VP in a company, and I was talking to another VP. He was HR. I was international pricing, and I was trying to hire someone. And I was like, "This is what I need. She's awesome for this role. Let's hire her." And he was like, "Okay." And here's our benefits package. And the benefits package was like, if I remember right, she had to work 2 years. After her first year, she got 5 days of vacation. There were no sick days. Like just. No bereavement, no, like all these things are just terrible. And I said, well, how is that good? Right. And, you know, he's like, well, it's legal. We're doing the legal limits. I'm like, yeah, but it's not moral. Right. And so how are you, benefits, you think benefits are, this is what we're giving the company. Benefits are your calling card and your separator from your competition to get the best people in your company. And if you have better benefits, people want to come. Right. And so I think what you're talking about is helping organizations kind of focus on actually caring about the people that are there, because it's going to lower their costs as well if they have a healthier workforce. I mean, it just does.
Yeah. So, there's some irony in having a human resources department, but not valuing the humans.
Mm-hmm.
I hope that every listener starts to understand that employee health and well-being is actually a business line, just like finance, marketing, communications. You need to treat it as if it's part of your business in order for it to succeed. You probably don't have a qualified person in your company is most likely. And that's okay because you're in good company with the other, your neighbors. But be aware of it and make sure you either help someone inside your company get trained, or maybe that's a position that you add to your roster.
I think it's great.
I want to turn to your book, but I can't not comment on what PJ just said, because I think what's really interesting about the choice to bring someone on to into the organization, invest in them, whether it's time, effort, money, training, resources, put them in front of your clients, and not think about how to ensure that, you know, just as you would make sure that you're paying the heating bill for your building, because that's good for that's common sense, right? But the lack of common sense around taking care of your employees is startling. And yet, as much as it might seem obvious to us, the fact of the matter is it's still not obvious to an awful lot of corporations who run the business based on counting dollars and not necessarily appreciating what brings the dollars in. Let's talk about your book. You wrote A Cure for the Common Company. I know that was a big deal that took you, that was an effort of love. Thank you. That's a great book. I have a signed copy in my library. It lays out a framework for workplace well-being. You have a companion journal that you participated in releasing. Both of those are available on Amazon. I could not recommend them enough. They're not only insightful, they're also fun and funny, just like Rich. But what's one simple practical change? And I know that that's, you know, boiling the ocean down to one thing is always tough. But what's one thing just about any company could implement today that would rapidly improve their employee well-being?
That's a variation of a question I get a lot. What's one thing I could do? Put well-being on the agenda. Now, it's not very, in some regards, it's specific, because you literally need to put well-being on the agenda of your standing meetings so that you can address it at the standing meetings. But it's really not specific, because there are so many different companies and so many different needs that it would be difficult for me to tell you what fills that agenda. But at least having a placeholder, just like you have a placeholder for quality assurance or a placeholder for your sales numbers, if you don't have a place at the table or the agenda for well-being, you're going to forget about it as soon as you're possibly done listening to this episode. So go back, figure out which meeting well-being needs to be part of the agenda, and put it on, and then work from there.
Just a quick follow-up, and you know, I have my, in my consulting practice, I work with one very, very large multinational company called Grupo Bimbo, and their meetings start with a culture short and something related to the health and well-being of their staff. Every single group meeting starts with these things.
That's right.
And that sends a message. I mean, before we talk about business, we're going to talk about you.
Yeah. Mm.
And I absolutely love that. And as I talk to prospective clients and other organizations, I tell them that I find that to be impactful. And I think it goes to the very point of, hey, put it on the table. Keep it in people's line of sight. It's amazing what just that awareness can do.
Yeah. I mean, some teams practice some type of gratitude exercise at the beginning of their meetings. We have some teams inside Hopkins that start with a mindful moment. If you can do that at the beginning of a meeting, it puts people in a better mood. It helps settle them, and they can be more focused during that meeting. It's a benefit for the individual as well as the team.
I love all that. And what is a culture short? Is it like a little video?
No, it doesn't have to be, but it can. It's usually just a write-up about something that matters in the organization, a value that the organization really cares about. And it's a rotating set. Generally speaking, at any given time, there are new ones that are being released, and they're wonderful. I mean, there are opportunities to put aside business and talk about, hey, you know what? We're humans. Let's talk about something we all share. We're coming oftentimes on these calls, there are people dialing in from all over the world. Yeah. Completely different cultures, different times of day. And we have a moment to have a shared humanity, which I absolutely love.
You know, at the beginning of this episode, we talk about some of the business benefits. And I didn't get to list them all, but when you share this, Tal, it reminds me that when we can share well-being stories about ourselves and help Others feel like they are in a similar situation or that we can get help from another person. And we start to see this collaboration. When people are well, they tend to be more creative and they tend to work better together, which is ultimately better for the team and the company, another business benefit.
I love that. So what are the benefits, if we didn't cover them all? What are other ones that you wanted to bring up?
Oh, boy. I don't think I brought up disability insurance because people are less likely to get injured, whether it's in or outside of work. They won't have to draw on their disability. There's a variety of others, PJ. I think I must have given you six or seven at this point. There's more in the book.
Okay. So we'll have to read the book to get all the all the nuggets.
I mean, not to mention, so you can, or the right person can, figure out the financial return on investment of a specific strategy, like helping someone quit smoking, beyond the healthcare claims, because there's published literatures on some of these more common unhealthy behaviors.
Okay. So let's go to a very common theme that we cover a lot on this podcast, which is resilience. So, you know, Tal was telling me resilience is a big theme in all of your work. You've had to navigate uncharted waters in your career. Yeah. Is there a personal experience, even like farther back, you know, way back in the heyday of Rich, that you've had to tap into your own resilience to keep going, like something that's a lesson you've learned that's carried you forward?
I wish I could say there was a specific instance, but you asked me to go way back. So I'll go back to college. And I finished my freshman year of college, and I was looking at 4 years of biology, and I really wasn't enjoying studying plants. No offense to the botanists out there. But I wanted something different.
Huge segment of our audience are botanists, and you just offended them all.
Yeah,
just...
I'm sorry to cut off that segment of the listening population.
The riots are going to be huge.
So you can splice it out. So I started to look at a curriculum at Cornell, and I had looked at Cornell earlier, but I kind of was putting myself through college, so wasn't ready to leave a state school. And they have a nutrition degree there. And so, PJ, you know, transferring is not easy, but I was determined to enjoy what I was learning. So I did transfer. And I got a degree in nutritional biochemistry. And when I went to medical school, that was very unusual to have a medical student who had a nutrition degree. And I think I've only met about five other doctors in my generation who studied nutrition. And I'm glad I did study nutrition, because it's helped inform a lot of the work I do today. So in that regard, I guess I demonstrated resilience by feeling like something was wrong and being able to assess and understand what was wrong and pivot and make a different decision. I mean, it's really not the kind of resilience examples you've had with some of your other guests. Like, I believe you had Crystal Ball a few episodes ago. Yep. I've been fortunate in that way. Most of my resilience work is... really to help healthcare workers who are regularly facing very challenging patients and situations that, you know, without some skills could really take a heavy toll.
Well, I mean, resilience can be forced upon you, or it can be, you know, self-made. Yeah. And so I'm happy that, you know, you had the emotional intelligence and the awareness to sit there and say, well, I can really hit my head against the wall for the next 4 years, or I can go do something that I really want to do. And then you had the chemistry to do that, right? So I think that's a testament to you. I think that's great.
Well, thanks, PJ. I'm lucky. I'm very lucky for a lot of reasons.
So entrepreneurs, which our audience is about 75% of our audience are entrepreneurs, they struggle with self-care tremendously.
Yeah.
They all do.
I obviously am an entrepreneur myself. I recall I'm now 51 years old. In my earlier years, more so than now, I worked insane hours. As you know, I've always been a fitness fanatic. So I've stayed healthier than maybe I would have otherwise. But What advice would you give someone who is so focused on scaling or building their business that they are neglecting their own well-being?
Yeah, the older Rich Safir telling the younger Rich Safir, which I'll tell your audience, is to pay more attention to your sleep. You know that I'm also driven. And I think my good eating patterns and my love of exercise helped me along the way. But if I could do it over again, I would have worked harder and been more intentional to get more sleep. Over the past couple of decades, the research around the ill effects of not enough sleep, like increasing the risk of cancer, dementia, things that none of us want, should be enough to help most rational people try to tame the amount of hours, the number of hours that they work during the day and have a little more balanced. I get enthusiastic. I never started my own business, but I kept pushing the boundaries of employee health and well-being. I will tell you, when you sleep better, you're going to be more creative and more productive with your time. Just because you work longer doesn't mean you're more successful.
So true.
Yeah. And, you know, there are people who wear, you know, I only sleep 4 hours a night as some sort of badge of courage when what they're telling me when they say that is, I'm significantly less effective than I could be. That's what I'm hearing as a leader when someone tells me how little they sleep. Now, there are obviously moments in any project or profession where you have to do that, but that cannot be your way of being as a general rule. Interestingly, I just got we get a lot of emails from listeners and viewers, and someone recently wrote to me about the Marquell Russell episode, and he wrote, I have it in front of me, and he wrote, when Marquell said being physically present as a parent and being emotionally present are completely different things, that hit hard. I realized I wasn't paying the attention I thought I was paying, right? So that's parenting, and that's another element of it. But in general, we tend to not see something, even if it's obvious, it's right there in front of us, until, generally speaking, unfortunately, something bad happens. And with your health, if something bad happens, it could well be irreversible, right?
Yeah.
We talked at the front end of the episode about a friend of ours that I believe had a heart attack, if I recall correctly. It was a long, long time ago, right? So it pays to pay attention to your health, even if you're a driven entrepreneur. And if you're hearing people out there touting, you know, just how hard they work and how little they sleep, just appreciate that what you're really hearing is someone who doesn't have the right balance. That's how I view it. Not judgmentally, just more from a place of, okay, well, that's a data point.
We spend more waking hours working than anything else for a good chunk of our life. So if you're not integrating well-being with your workday, you're missing out. And it's easier to be healthier and well when you surround yourself with people who are healthy and well, which is exactly why you need to put together a strategy for the workplace.
I love this. I love this. And, you know, of course, Tal is kind of a fitness fanatic, right? You are obviously healthy. Richard, you and I are basically the same age. I'm 56. And I've always said, you know, I'm in shape, round as a shape, all the things, all the self-deprecating things. But there is something that someone told me like a few weeks ago that really kind of hit me hard. And that is 20 years from now, you're going to wish you had the body you have right now. And I was like, oh, yeah. Interesting point.
You know, there's a lot of data, physical fitness data, that shows that how physically fit you are supersedes your body weight. In other words, PJ, if you're really physically fit, that's going to more than offset any excess body weight you might perceive that you have.
Okay. I will work on that fitness part then, sir. Thank
fitness
you for that.
Is important. It's not just body weight.
Sure. Sure. Well, thank you. And so you've implemented at Johns Hopkins this a strategy called Heart Math, which combines heart-focused breathing and positive psychology. What does that look like in practice? Are you sitting there saying Om with your fingers held in a certain way, or like how can you know someone listening try this technique?
So you know, there are many different ways to practice mindfulness. Some of your audience knows it by this sitting position, the lotus position with your fingers together saying Om. Yoga is another form of mindfulness, and so is heart math. Heart math is a certain type of breathing technique that essentially connects your mind with your heart. Now, some of your audience is like, whoa, this guy is way out there. You're going to have to give me the benefit of the doubt and know that there are nerves that connect our brain and our heart. But unfortunately, in this high-stress environment that we live and work in, the nerves are sending messages that are out of order. They're asynchronous. They're erratic. And when you do this type of breathing pattern combined with positive thoughts, it helps settle those nerves to get into a regular pattern. And once you have achieved that, you're going to be more calm, more focused. You're going to sleep better. There are good studies to show that it lowers blood pressure. There are 20 years worth of very good research papers that show the amazing benefits of this particular practice. PJ, I can't explain in the time we have for, and it's really wouldn't do justice, so I'm not going to try to explain how to do this at home. I think it's worth exploring if you're someone who wants to go down that path.
Oh, absolutely. Is it in your book, or you're talking external?
It's not in, you know, I do weave mindfulness through the book, but I don't specifically call out heart math. That is a trademark from a company that has done this research and has a specific set of skills.
Very cool.
So if you're in the audience and you're interested in learning more about it, I'm sure Rich will be happy to talk to you about it. In our show notes, we're going to have his LinkedIn page. Let's move on to some lighter topics a bit, but also tie them into the work you do. You've been an empty nester for a few months now. Your daughter, the last of the three, left. She's at the University of Delaware. How has that changed the way you approach your own health and well-being? Being an empty nester, has that given you any kind of a new perspective on balance?
Well, my wife and I went to hip hop. I didn't buy a sports car. We went to hip hop instead. So, we are trying to get the fun back in our week, literally. I mean, you know, we're so focused on raising our kids, and I don't have any regrets. I mean, actually, you know, Tal, the only regret I have is I wish I could have been more emotionally available, as you referenced earlier, to some of my kids at some portions of their life. I want to have more fun. We're having more fun. We're doing other things that we used to do while we were dating and engaged, and we're getting back to it.
Oh, that's great. That heartening for me, because I have three, one that's graduating high school this year and then two next year. And I have two others that are out and way more.
Yeah, you're going cold turkey.
I know. It's going to be rough, but I can't wait to see our grocery bills, because it's going to be so much less.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, there's definitely some adjustments. I don't want to say it's all glory. I mean, we do miss them, and some days are a little bit tougher than others.
Of course. So you've hiked and camped, from what I've heard, in some of the most beautiful places in the world. And I don't know if you've hung out at Yosemite behind you, right?
There you go.
What's one of the outdoor experiences that left a lasting imprint on you about well-being?
Yeah. So to celebrate my 45th birthday, a friend and I went to Peru for 10 days, and we hiked the Inca Trail and finished at Machu Picchu.
Wow.
And it was just spectacular and amazing. And for anybody who's been there, you'll know the next part. We got to sleep in a motel that night, which was glorious, and a shower. And we followed up the next day by hiking Huayu Picchu, which is a mountain behind Machu Picchu, which would be illegal in the United States. Either that, or there'd be tons of lawyers who would have you sign your life away, because literally you could lose your life on that one without rails and steady footing.
My lordy.
So, and I missed that trip, and I wish we could take it. We've hiked together before. We've talked about doing some of that stuff. I've not been quite the outdoorsman you are. I have picked up, as you know, cycling. I'm now an extremely passionate cycler, cycling typically 75 or so miles a week. But I feel like I want to hike more, and I feel like you'd be a great guy. So I'm looking forward to having the opportunity to do that in the not too distant future. I want to finish with the quote you gave us. You said that your intent is to be calm, content, and connected. That was the quote you gave us, the original quote you gave us. And we're in a world, especially now, I mean, we don't need to, you know, it's a world where we are constantly being pulled in different directions. It is exceptionally hard to stay calm with everything that's going on around us. Being content when we are bombarded with advertising that tells us that we don't have this and we should have that and we are not quite this. And being connected. All of those things are incredibly challenging things to do. It's great to have that as a goal, but what do you do? What are some mindful things you do to stay aligned with these goals?
Sure. Well, I am calm. I've been practicing mindfulness for, I don't know, 7 or 8 years now, and yoga for about 25 years. So that's helping. And I'd encourage anyone who's tried it and didn't like it, try it again with a different teacher, a different app, because like any other behavior, it may have been just not a good experience, just alter a little bit. So I am calm, I am content. So I practice gratitude. I learned that through my mindfulness and my meditation. In fact, there's a line, a prompt for gratitude in the journal that you mentioned, A Cure for the Common Workday. So I do that every morning, and it slowly creeps in throughout my day. And when you're thankful for what you have and see some of the terrible things that are happening around our communities, our country, the world, it makes it easier for you not to focus on what you don't have or, you know, whatever you perceive to be a shortcoming. And I am connected. The last C in my intent is my recognition about the importance of people in my life. So I've been able to put my phone down a lot more over the last few years. I'm much more intentional. So I'm not getting bombarded by advertising as much because I'm not on my phone. And I am making time to connect physically in front of someone, and it's working. You know, I kind of lost that during my, you know, the 20 years we were raising kids before they started going to college. You know, my wife and I, we both made a sacrifice a bit, as do many people with their friends.
That's got to be great for your well-being, your mental well-being.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. I mean, I'm very lucky. I've had a very full career. I had a great executive coach help me understand that if I were to celebrate once a week something I accomplished that week, then I probably wouldn't feel like I needed to keep moving the goalposts and continuing on a pace that really wasn't gonna help me with the next stage of my life, which is retirement. So I'm grateful for her to help me build that practice into my week.
I love that.
You know, I want to end by telling a little something that Rich has been doing since I've known him, which is he sends out an end of year letter. He sends out an end of year letter, and he's been doing this for decades now to close people that are in his close orbit, where he talks about the year that was. His wife's, his kids' career. You know, it inspired me to do something this year that I've been thinking about doing. And I started to do it, figuring, you know, it's a new year. It's easy enough to do. I set a jar. And in that jar, on a weekend, I told Rich I'd be doing this. On a weekly basis, I put in a note of something great that happened this week. One thing great that happened to me that week. And my goal is, on New Year's Eve or the last week of the year, I'm going to pull open the jar and I'm going to read them all. And you know, what an easy way to experience again dozens of highlights from 1 year. Because I do believe that gratitude ultimately is the most important emotion we feel. We spend a lot of our life focusing on what we don't have, not nearly enough on what we do. And the acronym that I choose to follow is RAIN, which is recognize, accept, investigate, and nurture. Recognize what makes me tick. Accept the things that, and this is obviously not something I invented, but accept the things I can control and learn to live with the things that I cannot. Investigate when I'm not feeling right. What's the cause? Oftentimes it's self-induced. What can I do about it? And nurture, nurture myself, nurture the people I care about. And it's so easy when you think about it. I mean, rain, I make it rain, right? I've always talked about that as a professional. As a professional, as someone who's been in sales a lot, making it rain is something I think about all the time. But when I read, when I use that acronym for what really matters in my life, it put a whole new perspective on things. And, you know, having Rich as a friend for so many years, and we are not just casual friends. That word is tossed around. He's one of my very, very best friends in the world. And having someone with his mindset and his disposition and his love of life and love of family and love of friends, that's one more thing I would say to anyone in the audience. Man, if you have friends like that, nurture that. And if you don't, go find them. It's never too late to find friends like that. So I just want to end by saying, Rich, it's such a pleasure to have you on. You are an inspiring human being, a great professional, a great person. And I'm sure that our audience learned a lot from having us interview you today. We'd love to have you back someday. I'm thinking you might have one more book in you. I don't know if you agree.
My wife doesn't agree.
but if you do, we'd love to hear about it. And if you have anything else you think that the world needs to know more about, we'd love to be a platform for you to share that with the world.
Thank you, Tal. Thank you, PJ. Tal, this summer we'll have an adventure. We'll pick a place.
I love it. I can't wait.
I'll come too. Why not?
I don't know if we'll invite you, PJ. No, I'm joking. You're there. You're invited anytime. You're another one of these angels in my life. So sure, you can come.
Hey, look, gratitude, just really quick. My wife and I have been, we just celebrated 7 years, and she and I have been for whatever reason, over the last like 6 months, every morning when we wake up, the first words out of our mouths are how grateful we are to each other.
That's great.
You know,
I love that.
I don't know how we fell into this kind of routine, but I absolutely love it. It's so
if good. I woke Beth up at 5 a.m., she'd kill me, but I'm glad that you and your wife glad wake up at the same
that
time.
That she's grateful you're not doing that.
There you go. Rich Zafir, it was a pleasure. Thank you so much for being our guest today.
Thank you.
And that's a wrap, folks. Like what you heard, want to support the show? Please follow our page on LinkedIn and Facebook. Visit us on YouTube. And please like and rate us on all of your favorite podcast streaming services. You can also see exclusive content, subscribe for free to our weekly blog, support our sponsors, and soon buy our merchandise at www.bravingbusiness.com. Thanks for being a part of our production. And we'll see you next time on the Braving Business Podcast.